Hello, Lorena Allam here. Welcome to Hindsight here on RN. Bert Lincoln was a 24-year-old crew member of the steam yacht Aurora during the Antarctic summer of 1913. The Aurora was meant to pick up Douglas Mawson and his companions after their expedition to the magnetic pole and then return to Hobart. But of course, Mawson's expedition struck disaster and his two companions died on the ice. Alone, Mawson made it back to the base at Commonwealth Bay, only to discover that just hours before his return, pack ice had forced the Aurora to leave and it couldn't come back for him until the following summer. When the working crew signed on for the voyage, they were told they were not to take any photographs or keep a diary of the journey, as this was deemed to be the exclusive preserve of the officers and scientists. But deckhand Bert Lincoln did keep a diary, and he kept it hidden under his bunk. As far as we know, his is one of only two accounts of the voyage, as told by the working men on the ship.
December the 25th, 1912. I'm aboard the expedition ship Aurora. We are lying in Hobart but are leaving tomorrow, Boxing Day, for Antarctica to pick up Dr. Mawson and his party on the ice. Today we were the guests of our captain J.K. Davis at a Christmas dinner at the Oriental Hotel. It was a flash affair. Sailing day. We left Hobart at 10 a.m, had a great send-off from a large crowd. We have on board 40 sheep for fresh meat. We proceeded to Browns River, where our 23 dogs came from the quarantine station. We had fine weather until midnight, then got a heavy headwind, and a big sea rose up and made things a bit uncomfortable. The sheep started tumbling about and the dogs howling and fighting, as is the fashion of the Eskimo dogs. December the 28th. The weather is gradually growing worse. The wind is enough to blow a man off the bridge while standing. Sprays are dashing high over the funnel, as high as the topsails. I nearly got hoisted over the wheel by a spoke catching between the buttons of my big quartermaster's overcoat as the wheel gave a kick. The dogs are howling and fighting. Passengers, who are members of the expedition and are supposed to help with the work, are down in the cabin lazing and having a good time and leaving their work to us. And they will go back to Australia and boast of all the work they've done. But all the work of this expedition is being done by the six sailors and bosun. The weather is worse again this morning, and a heavy southerly gale is blowing with heavy hail showers. Our forecastle is swimming with water, and some bunks are soaking wet. By midnight, the weather was so bad, the seas were thundering aboard from fore to aft, and the wind had risen to a proper hurricane. Us sailors wonder what we can see in it, to come to sea. Then someone will strike up. All the nice girls love a sailor. So we decide that must be the reason we stick at it. December 31st, 1912. At 1 a.m. we very nearly had a calamity as the second mate got knocked off the bridge, taking with him the temperature box and its gear. He went out through the port bridge railing and struck the rigging. Then he dropped to the main deck and was in imminent risk of being washed overboard before I could reach him. which I eventually did. The officer of the watch struck 8 bells for us and also blew the steam whistle like mad while 2 more of us spun the captain round. The stokers were up on deck banging away with their shovels and the relieving watch poured up on deck and joined in too. We made a gloriously magnificent noise, especially as the 23 Eskimo dogs all started howling, squealing and fighting at the time. The old man jumped out of his bunk and underpants onto the bridge and was choking with rage. Till he remembered New Year's Eve.
An old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind. Good old acquaintance be forgot and day of all that.
January 1st, 1913. New Year came in with much finer weather and the sea is moderating. We tightened up the main rigging and the topmast backstays this morning by frapping and tying in with tackles. During last night, the wireless operator caught passing messages from Hobart and New Zealand. Whiskey and stout was served today. 1 bottle of whiskey between 12 men and also 2 bottles of Imperial Russian Stout per man. And of course, the ones of us who didn't drink gave ours to our mates. The result was the sailmaker and 1 sailor were blue, blind, paralytic drunk and caused much fun as the ship was rolling. Came on deck this morning at 4 o'clock. During the night, 4 sheep died. Weather has suddenly grown fine again. I had the wheel from 5:20 to 6:40, and from then to 8 bells I was skinning sheep. Bosun and I dumped 2 more dead ones overboard without troubling to skin them. The ship's position today is 54 degrees south latitude, 144 degrees east longitude. Coming on deck at midnight, we found the Aurora Australis showing brightly all over the sky. It's getting gradually colder. The ship is getting a rig along, and the more the merrier, as it is the roughest and worst part of the world here. Among the ice, it is smooth seas and calmer weather. So hey ho for the ice! The 9th of January. We've had snow and sleet for 3 days now. We've not sighted ice yet. We started killing sheep today in earnest, killing a dozen, and the decks were covered in blood. The dogs had a Christmas. We've only 6 sheep left now, and they'll be killed tomorrow. Saturday, the 11th of January. We entered the ice drift at 12:30, and it was fairly heavy. But it was the prettiest sight I've ever seen. The blue sea with the white lumps of ice shining in the sunlight, and some of the larger pieces showing a bright blue. The old ship trembled and shuddered as she punched big lumps, The temperature is 32 degrees Fahrenheit. We've made fine headway today and tonight, and are now further south than Cape Horn, which most sailors consider as a ways south. January 13th. At 7:15 p.m. a heavy wind is raging and sprays are sweeping the bridge and funnel. There are little icicles hanging all over the ship. We must now be very careful as we are surrounded by drift ice and icebergs and the weather is getting very thick. We are now in latitude 67 degrees south and Adelie Land, Mawson's main base in Commonwealth Bay, was sighted at about 9:30 p.m. The wind is howling a treat and the cold cuts like a whip, but we crept to our anchorage about 1:30 a.m. All hands on deck getting anchors out. Commonwealth Bay. We are anchored in 15 fathoms of water and are about 50 yards from shore. The glacier here is like nothing you can imagine. At the face, it shows the ice in all shades of blue, from sky blue to pure white, with a layer of frozen snow covering all. There are numerous big crevasses intersecting the hill, and at the water's edge, these are continually splitting. Hundreds of tons of ice in the form of small bergs go thundering into the sea, making the old ship pitch and strain. At 2 o'clock this afternoon, the motor launch went ashore to Dr. Mawson's camp and brought aboard one of his men and some scientific specimens. But Mawson himself is not expected back for 2 or 3 days. He and his companions Mertz and Ninnis left for the magnetic pole on the 15th of December. In every ship on Sundays, a man has to be at the wheel steering, and at night a man on lookout. But other than those duties, there's no work on Sundays unless anything should suddenly go wrong. But in this ship, all the most needful work is left for Sundays on purpose. So much so, in fact, that of the 9 months I've been with Aurora, I've only had about 3 Sundays without working all my watch on deck when at sea. I used to be a great believer in everything British, but live and learn, I'll have to be hard up to sail again under an English flag. From now onwards, I'll go first under my own flag, Australian. Failing that, I'll go under a foreign flag. I don't mind hard work and plenty of it, but I hate so much overtime for nothing when on low wage. The officers, of course, only stand by and give orders, and when their watch is up, they go off duty. But we must keep going. And some of the officers are so mutton-headed that they give us double the amount of work that is necessary on account of this ignorance. Never mind. All the nice girls love a sailor. Ha ha. Thus ends our first Sunday at Adelie Land. Monday, January 20th, 1913. I hope Mawson and his men return soon, as we are supposed to leave here on the 25th for Gosberg, which is the western base, with Mr. Wilde's 8-man party. If we have to leave here without Mawson, the Aurora will either continue home to Australia and return here next summer, or come back to Adelie Land and freeze in over the winter. But they are doubtful as to whether the ship can stand the pressure of the ice during the winter. A search party of 3 men set out today in search of Dr. Mawson. They left the camp about midday. A big fall of ice from the glacier occurred about 6 o'clock this evening, causing a veritable ice field around the ship. One miniature iceberg with about 9 foot of ice showing above the water drifted onto our stern and pulverized itself into small lumps. We take such matters without concern, although such would send an iron or steel ship to the bottom very quickly. January the 24th. Tonight the wind is screaming through the rigging, although we're under the lee of the glacier, which is 400 or 500 feet high. The ship is straining heavily on her small anchor. The question, will the anchor hold, is much in use among us. And are we downhearted? No. This bay has been named Commonwealth Bay by Mawson, and the Aurora is the only ship that has been here. The weather has become rather squally, and at about 11:15 the cable parted from the anchor, so now we only have 45 fathoms of cable left. During our fortnight here, we have lost 3 anchors and 200 fathoms of cable, and have smashed up our windlass. It is a wonder that our captain does not steam ahead slowly when the squalls come, and take some of the ship's weight off her cable. But I suppose he's too much of a numbskull to know that. And of course, if he does not know it, we can't tell him, as he is captain and thinks he knows everything. His fellow officers are Jackie Know-alls too in their own estimations. January the 28th, 1913. It is pretty certain that a party will have to stay here till next year, and many are of the opinion that Dr. Mawson is now dead, unless he has got to the west coast and is living on penguins and seal meat. We are now steaming and drifting about the bay, as we can't very well anchor with our little kedge. We are supposed to leave here in a couple of days and go west to Gosberg to pick up Wilde's party, then head home to Australia. We, the sailors and firemen, will not be sorry to reach Sydney and pay off. We passed many very pretty icebergs today, and some we passed very close. And the men forward, who had cameras, were busy taking snapshots whenever we passed close to an exceptionally grand berg. They have to do it on the sly, of course, as we signed articles not to take any specimens, photos, or keep a diary, nor to say anything concerning the voyage for a period of at least 12 months after the expedition is finished. This, of course, is to allow Mawson and the scientists and the ship's officers to spin their tales without being contradicted by the sailors, because if the people of Australia knew as much of it as a man in the forecastle, they would be disgusted at the whole affair. Three days later, the captain said he would wait another 24 hours. If the weather continued bad, he will leave without Mawson's party. Icicles are hanging like stalactites a foot long. The rigging, backstays and every coil of rope are solid blocks of ice. We expect to be about a fortnight on the way to Gosberg, where Mr. Wilde, one of Shackleton's men, is in command, and to only be there a couple of days. Then, if the weather is mild enough, we return here, in case Mawson has reached the base during our absence. The chief mate must want a term of imprisonment for manslaughter, judging from his orders when the weather is exceptionally bad. He's thoroughly disliked by every man in the ship, both officer and sailor, on account of his dirty principles. I am putting rather too much in my diary according to the amount of paper I have, so henceforth I must cut down a little and put things short and sweet. February the 8th, 1913. Our watch was just turning in when a man on deck came and told us that the operator had just received a message from the main base saying, Mawson arrived. Metz and Ninnis, Mawson's two companions, dead. The message was faint, but was continually repeated in the hope of it reaching us. On receiving the message, the ship was immediately put about and headed for the base again. Sunday, February the 9th. Bad weather prevents Mawson and our team of six men at Adelie Base from reaching the ship. Captain Davis decided that Mr. Wilde and his Western party are in a very precarious position and we are going to Gosburg to get them, without delaying here waiting for fine weather to get these men on board. I heard the mate say, "We know the men who are left here in the main base at Commonwealth Bay are safe enough for 12 months or 2 years if necessary." To Gosburg, February the 12th, 1913. Early this morning in the 12 to 4 o'clock watch, I steered the Aurora close past a large iceberg by the light of the Aurora Australis. We expect to reach the base at Gosburg in about 5 days' time, so if we have good luck, we may be homeward bound in a fortnight. We set the foresail at 3:30 this morning. These icebergs are getting more numerous. The men from the Adelie land base go down in the hold and trim coal for the firemen in exchange for a bucket of water to wash in. Otherwise, they cannot have a wash as we are on a very low whack of water. These men are called the Talent by us chaps, so in future I will speak of them as such. February 23rd. At 11 a.m. this morning, we sighted a flag which floated from a pole near the Gosburg camp. The men from the base were in line on the floe with dogs and sledges, and as the ship came up to the floe, they cheered with a will, and we answered it. They were all safe, but they only had 2 dogs left out of 9. After the ship was moored, we were divided into 2 gangs. One took the stores which the shore party had left over, their specimens and gear. The other gang set about watering ship and had to hoist baskets of ice onto the poop and then lug them onto the snow tank while the Talent filled the baskets. If everything had been fair, our gang should have been sleeping whilst the Talent watered ship. We got away at 8:30 p.m. If we'd stayed overnight, we might not be able to leave for 12 months. February 24th, 1913. Homeward bound. The engines have been pounding away full speed since we left Gosburg. We are winding among scattered pack ice and icebergs, but not hitting much, which is a good job seeing the pace we are doing. About 8 knots. We are pounding, smashing and grinding away at the huge lumps, making the old ship have a rough time of it. It is marvellous how she stands it without getting holes knocked in her. Everybody has been busy these last 2 days, skinning penguins and getting the skins ready for stuffing. The emperors are said to be worth about £3 apiece when stuffed and mounted in a glass case, and the decks forward are a nice state every day. The seamen and firemen are all happy and good-tempered because the ship is homeward bound. If everything goes well, we expect to be in Hobart about the 16th of March. The icebergs are getting rarer, and those we see are getting very small, so I suppose we will soon be clear of them altogether. The ice that has been all over the rigging since we were in the pack ice has all disappeared. The Aurora Australis is giving us an illumination again tonight. The Talent are nearly all down with seasickness. They don't think of watch on deck or watch below now, but only lying in their bunks. They are mostly fine weather sailors. Sailors? March 1st, 1913. At 8 o'clock tonight, as we relieved water, it was inky black, and each man had to feel his way about. The Talent on deck, with the exception of two old chaps, did not attempt to help us. It was too rough for them. They might get some spray on them. Today, Mr. Wilde has been giving us chaps jerseys, caps and mitts, which he will have no further use for, but which will be very handy to us. I got a pair of Jaeger mitts with W on them. They're good warm ones. March the 5th. We had another fine aurora tonight, showing the arc of a circle across the sky with the stream shooting up from it and flickering in all directions. March 13th. Tonight at 7:30 there was a great excitement among the Talent when a man on lookout reported a light on the port bow. It was a revolving light at the southwest cape, Tasmania. Our watch did all the white paintwork under the forecastle head this morning. We want the ship to look a bit clean when she gets into Hobart, which will probably be Wednesday next. We entered the heads 20 to 30 miles from Hobart early this morning and steamed up to Port Esperance and landed Mr. Eitel, the secretary of the expedition. We had to land Eitel so that he could send news to London papers 24 hours before anyone landed in Hobart from the Aurora, as she was under cable contract. We were told about Scott's death. It was the first we'd heard about it. March 15th, 1913. We re-entered the heads early this morning and proceeded up to Hobart and moored the ship by 8 o'clock. Our beards greatly amused the girls in Hobart. While walking up the street to the barbers, our faces and beards proclaimed us as belonging to the Aurora. And everyone would give us a smile or a nod, and some would come back and talk to us. And altogether, we were made much of. After our voyage to the Antarctic. Thank you.
Bert Lincoln decided not to take another trip to the Antarctic and instead enlisted to fight in 1914, as he promised under the Australian flag. Corporal Bert Lincoln was killed in action in Palestine in March 1918. He was 30 years old. Bert Lincoln was described in Army notes as an exceedingly plucky man in action and very popular. His calling was noted as able seaman with Aurora from Hindmarsh in South Australia. Our thanks to Bert's great niece, Sharon Smith, for permission to read his diary. The diary was read for us by Michael Wally. The program was co-produced by Ros Bluett and Doug Quinn, with additional sound engineering by Timothy Nicastri. Up next, we revisit a remarkable story of Antarctic survival the year before Bert's voyage. It was the fateful winter of 1912, which has gone down in history as one of the worst on record. And while it claimed the lives of Scott and his companions, at the same time, another group, the Northern Party, did survive, incredibly, in the darkness of an ice cave for 7 months. That story up next. I'm Lorena Allam, and you're listening to Hindsight here on RN. In the winter of 1912, Robert Falcon Scott's polar expedition died on their return from the South Pole. When Scott was preparing for the journey, he invited 24-year-old Australian geologist Raymond Priestley to be a member of his six-man Northern Party. It would do scientific work while Scott's polar party made its way south. But when the terrible early winter set in, Priestley's Northern Party was forced to endure it in an ice cave on a snowdrift on Inexpressible Island. And then, having survived, they trekked 250 miles back to Scott's main base. As a small boy, Tony Fleming grew up hearing stories of this heroic Northern Party and his grandfather, Raymond Priestley, stories that had a major impact on him. Tony became the first member of their family to revisit Antarctica since that fateful winter of 1912.
It's 2:30 in the morning and I'm getting my first views of the Antarctic mainland, and it is amazing. This is where Granddad spent his first winter, the winter of 1911. We've got adelie penguins porpoising around us, a lot of free water, but a lot of ice as well, and the Admiralty Mountains ranging off in the distance. It is just the most magnificent view. As a geologist, Granddad must have been beside himself. This is just such a spectacular place. I just can't find words to describe it. It's beautiful.
March 1911. Cape Adare on the Antarctic mainland. Longitude 172 degrees, latitude 70. Geological surveying and sledging excursions. Duration of stay, 10 months.
We're now slowly steaming by a lot of floating ice. And much of that ice has adelie penguins on it. It's an amazing thing, but this voyage now starts to make sense to me. When I was travelling in the Southern Ocean, even visiting the subantarctic islands, I just couldn't envisage what it was like to be here. And it's not just the landscape, it's not just the beauty of the place. It's also this thing about reconnecting with my grandfather. I didn't know him very well. And this just makes it, that connection, more real. This is a place which meant a lot to him and a lot to my mother. And she would have loved to have been here. She is in Antarctica. Her ashes were scattered around in the Australian Antarctic Territory. It's a crazy thing, but this just brings back all those memories. Anyway, I've got to get ready to land and enjoy this wonderful place and meet a million Adélie penguins somewhere over there. There's this huge colony of Adélie penguins. And while it's very quiet up here at the top of the ship, once I get there, I probably won't have a thought to myself.
January the 8th, 1912. Glaciology and specimen collecting. Terra Nova Bay. Anticipated stay, 6 weeks.
We're surrounded by a million Adélie penguins. And it's just an awesome sight.
February 1912. Early winter conditions set in. No sign of ship's return. Begin search for ration depot and consider moving across to Inexpressible Island.
As we're sailing down through Terra Nova Bay and Inexpressible Island is about to come into sight, it will be a wonderful experience to be at that landscape, at that point in Antarctica where those stories originate from.
Well, welcome to Inexpressible Island. I don't know whether people have worked out, what we've got is an island surrounded by glaciers on both sides. So all we can really see is the eastern side of the island. So we're just looking at the eastern side, the northern, western and southern coasts completely surrounded by glaciers. That's a big glacier, the Priestley coming down there.
It became obvious to them that they were in trouble. Despite the fact that they could see clear water offshore, there was no ship. In fact, the ship tried 3 times to reach them and very nearly got stuck in pack ice on the 3rd attempt. And then the ship's captain, Pennell, knew that he had to head back to New Zealand and leave the Northern Party to their fate.
Inexpressible Island, 164 degrees east, 75 degrees south. Food rationing begins March 1912. Duration of stay, 7 months.
The site
came to be known as Inexpressible Island, and I think that speaks volumes for their winter. This island is raked by katabatic winds throughout the winter. Grandad records barely 24 hours of calm for 8 months. Katabatic winds average a speed of about a force 8 gale. That's just the average. And there are sustained gusts and sustained periods where it's at hurricane strength. So God alone knows how they survived the winter here.
Down on the north side and on the south side of it. Inexpressible, and Tony's told you why it's inexpressible. It's going to be inexpressibly cold this morning. It's going to be inexpressibly cold, but the reason we're going to have a go now is that it is doable, and this evening it might not be doable. So we'll take the opportunity while we've got it. There's no danger involved, the Zodiacs are quite safe, but they will be a little splashy. With the wind that's there, and so I do ask that you dress very warmly. Dress very warmly.
It's going to be a wonderful thing to be able to see the location, to get a sense of the landscape that Grandad endured that winter in. Fortunately, we're seeing it on a good day. There's blue sky, it's a beautiful landscape, and I'm hopeful that there won't be too many winds.
Okay, the plan is we're going to drop the anchor here. We'll be using the starboard side gangway. I'm going to put a couple of boats in the water. And because of the winds coming out of this quarter here, we hope to get a little bit of lee on this corner just in here for a landing. You can walk along there. It's quite rocky underfoot. It's quite rocky. There's boulders, granite boulders there. And the igloo, or the site of the Northern Party, it's up the hillside. You can't walk on the flat, you've got to boulder hop across. You will be boulder hopping, it's just not walking on flat ground all the time, you're just having to walk across the boulder.
April 1912. Snowdrift located. Excavation of ice cave as winter darkness sets in.
I'm sitting on the site of the Northern Party's ice cave, basically sitting where it was, and I'm just staggered at the harshness of this environment. And how on earth did they survive a winter here? They didn't have a lot of equipment to build the ice cave, and in fact they had to use Grandad's picks and geological picks that he used for exploration. But somehow they were able to hack out a cave 8 foot by 12 foot, maximum height about 5 foot 6 inches. And there they resided for about 7 or 8 months. The sun doesn't rise in the winter here, and the only light they had was a blubber lamp, which is about 1 candle power in strength. And the blubber stove, which they used to cook food, didn't burn cleanly. And so the cave very quickly developed this black, sooty interior. They called it smitch.
May 1912. Shortage of seals for food. Ptomaine poisoning and dysentery. Inability to stand upright in snow cave. Torture.
The story of Scott's Northern Party and the part that Grandad played in its survival have become key stories in our family. In some ways, I ended up getting sick of Grandad's story, because whenever I complained about anything, Mum said, "Oh, what your Grandad had to endure."
Heavy blizzard sets in. Hazardous ventilation problems. severe food rationing ongoing, but Saturday night sing-songs continue.
When the Northern Party was digging its ice cave and then settling in, way down south, Scott and his party were nearing their end. It's probably good that he didn't know, because their morale was fragile at that stage. It strengthened during the winter, surprisingly enough. But it would have shattered them all to know the fate of the Polar Party.
August 10. Accurate calculations that the sun is due to return. Plans for trip to main expedition base at Cape Evans underway. September the 30th, 1912. The sledge journey to Cape Evans begins. 250 miles south. Arrive at Cape Evans, 5th of November, 1912.
And one of the most amazing things about it is that at the end of all of this, they then had to self-rescue, pull sledges 250 miles across the Drygalski ice barrier, down the coast, across unknown land to them, to find safety at Cape Evans. It's such a strong family story that it's an amazing thing to be here, to just stand in Granddad's footsteps for just a few minutes, to see what he saw and to feel what he felt. I didn't know Granddad very well, but the story has been retold in the family. It was very, very important to my mum, and she made sure all us kids understood it.
There at Cape Hallett, and remarkable leadership, remarkable resourcefulness, but to actually then, at the end of winter, walk to Cape Evans was remarkable. The whole feat was overshadowed by Scott's death and the recovery of...
It's a remarkable journey, that, and like I say, overshadowed by Scott's death. If Scott hadn't died, I think, and had been second to the pole, this story would have been the story that that was probably taught in the schools or read in the schools, you know, other, but now it's sort of, it's below the radar a wee bit, sadly. But it's a story that's never really been fully appreciated, I think. So to come here and to actually sit amongst the rocks and to, it's overwhelming, I think. It's just to see the conditions into which the Northern Party lived here, to see the bones of the seals, the dead penguins, and just to try and picture in their mind what it would have been like to spend that winter here.
Many at Cape Evans Hut had given up the Northern Party for dead, and there was great celebration when they finally walked in the door. But just a few days after that, the recovery team, which had gone south to find out what had happened to Scott and the Polar Party, came back and retold their grisly discovery. So there were very mixed emotions
for many, and for Grandad in particular. The Heritage Conservation Team, which have been working on the Discovery Hut, have packed their supplies in the chopper and they're about to head off to McMurdo Base to catch a flight back to New Zealand. Choppers are the modern sled of the Antarctic. I'm sure those explorers 100 years ago would love to have had that sort of transport available to them. There goes the Eurocopter. Very comfortable inside. They got a spectacular view and they're safe.
Return to Inexpressible Island was recorded and narrated on location by Tony Fleming. Extra readings were by Gary Bryson, and our thanks to Rodney Russ and the crew of The Spirit of Enderby. The sound engineer was Judy Rapley, and the piece was produced by Ros Blewett. And Tony Fleming is now director of the Australian Antarctic Division. His grandfather would no doubt have been very proud. In fact, you can hear the incredible story of Raymond Priestley's survival at our website. There's also extracts from his diary explaining how they survived 7 months inside that ice cave. We've also posted a slideshow of photos taken by Tony during his voyage south. Just go to our page at the Radio National website and you can podcast these stories as well. It's really worth a visit. Thanks for listening to Hindsight this afternoon. My thanks also to Joe Wallace. I'm Lorena Allam. We'll be back with you next Sunday at 1 with more history on Hindsight here on RN.
Story about a secret?
I looked deep into my soul and saw exactly who I was.
Be part of RN's Pocket Docs competition by writing or recording a true story about a secret. The best written story wins an iPad mini, while the best audio story wins a digital recorder.
No one could actually identify him, even though a lot of people said looks like.
Pocket Docs, a secret revealed. Oh, and you have to mention something you can fit into a pocket. Head to the RN homepage for all the details.